Hello, and welcome to Helvetic, a podcast. I'm Joe.
And I'm David.
And this is a podcast where we discuss the intersection of theology and design. David, do we have any follow-up?
We do. We have follow-up here. One of the things I wanted to say is that last episode, I talked about the things that you make not being gold. Actually, to kick things off, we did miss an episode last week. We're really sorry about that. I was sick. Joe was busy. I was busy. Joe was not sick.
That's right. Actually, this last weekend, I went camping, and it was intense.
Did you actually go camping?
I did, and right. I was in a tent. Oh. I said if it was in trailers, that really wouldn't help.
Yeah, I don't even know if that's camping. Camping is being voluntarily homeless.
Yeah, okay, I was that this last weekend.
Practicing. So anyway, so we're sorry we missed an episode. We try to get episodes out every week, but we kind of realized that with both of our schedules and the fact that we have lives and commitments to people, this is not as high on the priority list as maybe listeners would love for it to be. So we do apologize, but, you know, we do what we can. So anyway, last episode, I talked about the things you make or the things we make not being gold as we first start, as you first get started as a designer. And I just wanted to point out that some of the new things that you'll be learning as you use maybe some of the techniques that we've talked about or some of the techniques we've talked about or other people have talked about, you might find that you don't actually use that technique for years. I know that there are concepts and techniques that I learned watching Andrew Kramer videos that I just used for the first time, and Andrew Kramer from VideoCopilot.net, that I just used for the first time when making the We Distinguish trailer, but I remembered them. Does that make sense, Joe?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. In fact, it's hard to have that immediate use for that knowledge right out of the gate. Sometimes you just have to be always learning, always refining your technique, always figuring out new things and new ways to do things. And then you're going to have a
motorcycle.
Well, there goes my motorcycle. No, it's the wrong type of engine. It's totally sounded wrong.
No, it was totally yours.
Okay, well, then it's broken and I didn't want it anyways.
They strapped another engine to it. Because that's how that
works. That's how that works. That's how they steal them.
All right, you can keep going.
Anyway, if you spent a lot of time practicing your craft, refining your technique, getting better at kind of a broad range of skills loosely related to graphic design or web design or whatever things you're doing there, you'll find that you then have deep wells from which to draw when...
Well.
A deep subject. You see what I have to put
you'll
up
have
with?
Deep well to
now
draw
that
from.
I'm talking into the microphone...
I just won't let you finish the sentence.
Nothing. This guy's perfect. I have nothing to say to him. I must break him. I'm sorry. I'm being his inner monologue. I hate Joe so much right now. Yeah.
You should carry your thought along there, Joe.
Yeah, if only I could carry my thought along there. So anyway, what I was saying is you'll have some deep wells from which to draw when you actually are trying to create something new or different. Or even it'll take something that you have and maybe... you have an idea that's very similar to something you've done before, but now that you have better techniques and better skills, you'll be able to put those to use. And even though you're drawing inspiration from something earlier that you've created, it's going to look so much different and so much, hopefully better, but at least you'll be able to make it look different and, not be, redundant in your designs. How about that?
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't mean to encourage trying to learn a skill and then not using it for 4 years. All I mean to say is that can happen, and that's not always a bad thing. I had a Spanish teacher who used to say, if you don't use it, and then something about losing it. I don't know. I haven't talked very much about that.
His Spanish teacher went insane.
That's the takeaway.
Wait, weren't you homeschooled?
It was a co-op.
Oh, my heavens.
Anyway, speaking of Andrew Kramer, I mentioned him earlier. He is releasing some new 3D models this week. Pretty funny trailer if you check out videocopilot.net. I said it like him. Did you notice that, Joe?
I did. I totally noticed that. I almost said, "Hey, what's up? This is Andrew Kramer." And I've literally watched one of his things, but I've heard David say that about a million times.
Anyway, so he's releasing these three models, and he mentioned in a comment, which was a reply to one of my comments, but he mentioned in a comment that they have scrapped a bunch of the 3D stuff that they're releasing, or at least some of it, because it wasn't up to the level of quality that they were looking to release. And I just found that encouraging, because even the people that we look up to, that we admire their skills and their techniques or whatever, even they realize that something they've made might not be good enough to go out the door. And part of growing as a designer and growing into maturity is being able to recognize that not everything you make is gold, not get discouraged, and then go make something better.
Yeah. And also, it's important to note that if you have you make a comment on somebody's video or somebody's blog and they reply back to it, you're basically friends. So I just wanted to let you know that David and Andrew Kramer are now officially
besties.
Yeah,
we're like peanut butter
and mayonnaise.
It's probably more accurate. Both high in fat content.
That's right. Yeah, that's something I can say about both of you.
All right, so my mom had a couple of things to say. My mom is an artist. She does painting and sketching and just an all-around good artist. I've learned a lot from her. And she mentioned, because Joe, you had talked about always, what do you do with the first page again?
Sometimes I just, if I get a new sketchbook, sometimes I'll just take and scribble on that first page.
To ruin it.
Just kind of, well, part of it is just kind of to loosen up, but the other part of it is just like to go, okay, it's okay for this to not be perfect. It's not a, you know, this isn't something that I'm putting in a portfolio. This is a sketchbook. I want to sketch in it, and it's okay for the sketches to be just what they are.
Yeah, and my mom pointed out that she will just leave the first page blank and move on to the second page, which I guess also makes sense as a way to kind of overcome that. Because even...
Nope.
I think I might have mentioned this last episode, but even with... just being mean to my mom, it's fine.
This would be... Yeah, wow, this is just...
All right, we're going to move on now. I wanted to mention a what if your computer was an iPad commercial from Apple. You might have seen it if you have TV or the internet. Presumably you have one of those if you're listening to this. But they made an ad where they were really pitching an iPad as a computer, which is something we talked about all the way back in episode one. And if you're interested in the idea of using an iPad as a computer, you can listen to that episode. There's also a podcast called Canvas with Federico Vitici.
Sure, why not?
And some Scottish guy. It's actually really interesting.
Why not?
Because you hear this Italian accent and you hear this Scottish accent and you can't listen to it at 2x. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Let me tell you, that is a spicy haggis.
Mamma mia. All right.
Oh, yeah.
And then on Slack, we had lots of feedback. Zoom in the 1970s. The 1970s, Joe, not the 1990s. Zoom, there was...
What are you talking about? See, the thing is,
you
added this after you sent it to me and after I printed it.
It's so incoherent, too.
It is.
The TV show Zoom, where I mentioned that's the only reason I know the zip code for Boston, Massachusetts, 02134. And you were like, oh, well, you were the Zoom was a show from the 90s and you were too old for it when it came out.
Wait. But to clarify, I grew up in Montana, and we did not have TV until the 90s. What?
We also got several links for drawing challenges. Joe posted some of those, and some other people posted some of those. And we got references to the Reddit Photoshop Battles Reddit thing.
I love that thing.
Which is really good for practicing technique. Obviously, not so much design, necessarily, but for, you know, learning techniques, learning especially to use the clone brush and the quick select tool.
You know what it reminds me of, actually? The Photoshop battles makes me think of, I used to do rollerblading. And why does it make me think of that? Because I'm awesome. No, but I used to do rollerblading, and I struggled with just getting comfortable being out, like, riding down the streets on rollerblades. And a buddy of mine was like, well, let's go and do roller hockey. And so we went out and he had some friends. We'd just go out and do roller hockey underneath the interstate down here in Spokane. And what's really funny about that is I got so that I was not thinking about rollerblading. I was just thinking about, you know, my hockey stick. Yeah, it's a hockey stick. I almost call it a hockey racket. That's right.
Hark.
Or a hark.
That's a reference to the Charlie Brown Christmas special, or the second Charlie Brown Christmas special.
Okay.
All right. Somebody got that. Somebody out there got that reference.
I don't think so. We don't have enough listeners, buddy. You don't have.
We'll get feedback on the Twitters.
That's true. But what I was going to say is when I started playing hockey on rollerblades, I forgot about rollerblading. I didn't think about the process of rollerblading. And I just was able to, I was just going, trying to get from here to there so I could get the ball and hit it. Let's see. Something new I can do with the microphone.
Joe is,
now that I'm speaking
Joe's into talks
it.
Into his mic, but he frequently hits it with a pen.
No, but I, what I think about, so to pull this crazy analogy back, what I'm saying is in something like that Reddit Photoshop battles, it's this silly thing. Here's this picture. What sort of silly, crazy, funny thing can you think of to do with this picture? Well, the fun thing about that, or the neat thing about that, is you can actually, instead of worrying about Photoshop technique, you're thinking, well, how can I make this funny image that I have in my head, this funny idea? And therefore, you just start trying all the different stuff with Photoshop, and who cares if it's stupid and looks terrible? It's just forcing you to use the software a bunch. And yep. I think that's the fun thing about it. That was really where I was trying to circle back to.
Yeah, and you can get to the point, stuff like that can help you get to the point where you're not thinking about your tools, you're thinking about the end. You're thinking about, you know, what you want the finished product to be, not, oh, how do I use Quick Select again? How do I use Refine Edge, which they changed the name on in the recent release? Drives Super me fun. Bonkers. Actually, yeah. I do kind of like the new, whatever it's called, better than Refine Edge.
He likes it so much that he can't remember what it is.
Well, I don't get the newest version at work, so I only get it when I'm at home. And when I'm at home, I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is way better. But I don't know what it's called.
It's probably, I wonder if it's related to Affinity Photo stuff, because they had some really nice selection refinement tools.
I don't know.
I wonder if they kind of, that's the thing with Adobe is people are like, oh, this new thing came out and it's so much better than Adobe. It does things so much better. And Adobe's like, oh, let's throw $1 million at that idea. Boom. Now yeah, we have it and it's better.
And put it specifically in Photoshop. What is this? What do you mean it's a video editing tool? We're putting it in Photoshop.
That's exactly right.
Why does Photoshop make toast? I don't understand.
In fact, you have to make toast to complete this. All right.
So what's our topic today, Joe?
Our topic...
besides follow-up and feedback within follow-up.
Our topic is out of ugly fountains flow blessing. These things should not be. And also something about ponies, I think.
Yes.
Because no. David is moving stuff around crazy on his screen. So now I have to look at the printed thing.
Right. That's why you have the printed thing.
Listen, enough of your shenanigans. I think I've already told you this. All right. So now I've got it ready. No,
nobody's watching, Joe.
What we're talking about is pretty books with bad theology and great books with ugly covers. So how that happens, what we as Christians can do to push back against the tide of bad theology by helping to make
prettier books.
Make books that are less off-putting. Like, people will actually pick them up because, wow, that's an interesting cover. And then they'll actually get good theology instead of, wow, that's an interesting cover. I'm going to be a heretic now.
That's how that works, too.
How it works. In fact, they didn't even read the book.
If you've read...
just looked at the cover and became a heretic.
It was overwhelming. Yeah, so I thought we could talk about some examples. I feel like everybody is aware of the KJV-onlyists websites out there. For those of you who are aware, yes, I prefer the Textus Receptus, which means I prefer the Geneva Bible or the KJV. But that's a very different line of thinking from the KJV onlyists, who, I guess a summary of their position would be the only place that you can have the word of God is in the KJV Bible. And if you don't speak English, well, too bad. And if you don't speak Old English, well, too bad.
Yeah, I've actually heard people that, and I've actually had this conversation with people where they, it was an online thing. It was in an online forum, not face-to-face. I can't imagine that this would happen face-to-face, but who knows? Where the person that I was talking to, I said, well, what about Chinese Christians? What do they have to do? How do they get the word of God? And they said they have to read the King James Version. And I was like, well, so wait a minute. So they have to learn English, but wait, they can't just learn English. They have to learn 400-year-old English so that they can read the word of God. What if they read Greek and read the Textus Receptus? Nope.
What do you mean Greek? What's Greek?
Yeah, exactly.
These are the people who say if it was good enough
for Paul,
it's good enough for me. And they mean it.
Yeah. And they have amazing websites typically.
Yeah. So I was actually just going to pull this up so that we could critique it a little bit. KJV Bible.
Oh, KJV1611.com.
Oh, yeah. Is that what it is?
Oh, man. It's a keeper.
It should come up here, right?
Yeah, I would think so. It's probably should be early, but.
.com.
DOTCOM.
That's perfect. How I spelled it.
GreatSite.com. That's perfect.
Probably.
Not it.
Why? KJV only site. The KJV only.com. Nope. Well, actually, that's pretty terrible. So this is a repeating texture, and I've got a monitor here that's 2560 by 1440. It looks like the texture is about 64 by 64.
Yeah. So we only get to see it about 40,000 times on this page. It is not filling the screen.
Kind of makes me want to shrink my browser. And I don't have my browser open full screen here.
Yeah.
So we've got, I mean, right off the bat, I notice this is clearly word art. Do you guys remember word art, Joe? Do you remember word art?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got that amazingly.
That's what we got after. We got to use that after we finally got to get rid of our chart pack.
Get rid of your what?
Chart pack.
What's that?
That was rub-on transfer alphabets. So you'd actually have by alphabets that were on this kind of vellum, and they were printed on there with this black stuff. So you'd rub the other side of it against a piece of paper, and it would rub it off the vellum onto the piece of paper.
Wow.
Yeah, it was painful.
So we can compare that website, though, with Stillwater Revival Books, which is virtually all Puritan resources. They've also got some stuff from, I don't know if they have stuff, but they have endorsements from Joel Beakey, Vody, I don't know how to pronounce it, Bachman?
Vody Bachman.
Bachman?
Yeah.
Paul Washer. I mean, these guys are, you know, some of the towering intellects, arguably within evangelicalism, or at least, you know, widely known. Endorsing them. This is all Puritan stuff. It's stuff from the Puritans, from the Reformers. I mean, this is, I mean, even if you're not Reformed, you probably agree that there's some really good stuff in here. But this website looks like it's going to steal all my money and kill my family.
I think it might. I mean, but it'll do it with good theology.
Yeah. You've got white text on a red background. You've got giant yellow, all caps, so much all caps, yellow text on red. Like, who thought yellow text on red was a, oh, this is bad. And I think that when a lot of people, you can tell me if you agree with this, Joe, but I think when a lot of people compare these two, or when they come to Stillwater Revival Books, they immediately associate it with the KJV only websites.
I would agree 100%. It's one of those things, honestly, I find the site super off-putting.
Yeah.
I know they've got good stuff there, and I don't want to buy from them because I'm just like, gee.
These are the people who do the Puritan hard drive. And right. Actually, admittedly, the people behind this are associated with some movement that I can't recall off the top of my head that I don't want to support, which is actually the reason I haven't bought the Puritan hard drive, because it looks like a really cool thing.
And this hard drive sale ends in 4 hours, 1 minute, and 36 seconds. Unfortunately,
it's perpetually ending.
David is going to be posting this podcast in a couple of days.
I think this is a GIF. And I think it just starts again.
Wait.
Let me see here.
4 hours, 1 minute, 6 seconds.
No, I guess it is actually counting down. But they're just always running a sale.
It's from sale
sleazy.
To sale to sale. It's, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, this is the... Joe, you know what I'm saying here, right? You understand, like
I totally do.
I also had
so an let's not talk about it anymore.
I had an example of a Covenanter website. The Scottish Covenanters. Should I explain who the Scottish Covenanters are, Joe?
You should, because I have no idea who they are.
Really?
You know what? You just looked at me horrified.
Well, I thought I had mentioned them on here before.
Yeah,
maybe,
but. You know, and that's why I was kind of backpedaling. I'm like, wait a minute, I think we've talked a little bit about them, but you'd have to remind me.
The Scottish Covenanters were
it's Daniel Scott and the other people that covenant.
Danny Scott is actually on the watching the.
That's why I saw his comment.
Word art for the word, he says, which I don't think that's funny, Danny. I'm sorry.
No, it's terrible.
So the Scottish Covenanters. If you look into probably one of the easiest ways to understand kind of who they were and what they believed is to look into the Solemn League and Covenant.
What covenant?
The Solemn League and Covenant.
The Solemn League.
It's like the Justice League, Solemn League, and Covenant. But why don't I just describe, rather than getting into the history behind it, what they believed. Basically, they believe that. There's no way for me to describe this without it sounding crazy.
I'm sorry. Hang on just a second, because I have a visual of the Solemn League superheroes, and I want to draw them.
They're all wearing kilts.
Right now. We're pausing the podcast, people. No, I'm kidding.
All right, so the Scottish Covenanters believed essentially that all people are accountable to God's law, and God's natural law, and in a sense, the laws that's revealed in Scripture. So they would say, I've never actually had to summarize this position before, but they would say that the civil code, as given to us, the laws regarding what the government should, what Israel's government should do in the Old Testament, uh-huh. Those are still binding on modern magistrates. So they believe that capital punishment should be a thing for murder, for adultery, for homosexual acts, for kidnapping, for a number of other things. And one of the things I want to say, whenever I start talking about this, it starts to sound like people will say, well, that sounds really, really crazy. But before you respond that way, I would ask that you make sure that you have a legitimate argument from the New Testament on why those laws aren't binding. Because at some point in history, God saw that it was fit that people who kidnap other people should be put to death. And God said that that was just, right? So the idea of that being just, or that being crazy is not up for the debate. It's not up for debate. At some point, it wasn't crazy, right?
Yeah.
So the question is, now, is that still what people are accountable to? And this is actually the position of virtually all of the Westminster divines, and the Scottish Covenanters, and Calvin would have largely agreed with this position. So I don't say that to say, well, therefore it's right. All I'm saying when I say that is, therefore maybe you shouldn't call it crazy and completely dismiss it without looking further into it.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, the point of all of this is, the people who hold these views arguably are some of the closest people in their beliefs to the original 1647 Westminster Confession, Reformed theology, what basically a lot of modern Presbyterian churches, or something similar to what a lot of modern Presbyterian churches would say they hold. And so they're not crazy. They might be wrong. I don't think so, but they might be wrong.
Would you say that this is analogous to what we would today refer to as theonomy?
Yes, it's a form of theonomy in the sense that it says that the civil rulers should be put under the... I don't know why we're talking about this on Helvetic, but
that's fine.
In the sense that it says that the civil rulers should be put under God's authority, that they should be looking to God's law for how to rule. The difference between what most modern theonomists would say... so if you split the Ten Commandments into two tables, the first table being laws related to God, and the second table, the last six commandments being laws related to man, pretty much nobody disagrees with the fact that they're laid out like that. The theonomists, the Reconstructionist theonomists today, like Joel McDermott, Gary North, etc., they would all say that the latter half of that, the commands regarding neighbor, are the ones that are to be enforced, whereas the Covenanters would say that the civil commands regarding the first table should also be enforced. So what that means is that you should not be allowed to be a citizen of a covenanting nation and hold to a non-Christian belief. Not to say that you can't sojourn. There's a difference between being a citizen and being a sojourner. And right. and actually, covenanters would have open border policies for the most part. But the difference would be, in order to become an actual citizen, you would have to hold these things. And you would also have to not propagate doctrine about false gods. And if you were to do that, if you were to, say, be a Muslim and try to spread that, the death penalty could possibly occur. Not in all cases. You know, there may be a period of warning, depending on like how widely known this law is, etc. Like, I don't want it to sound like all of a sudden we're just going to start killing people. No, these laws would go into effect and people would be frightened by those laws. And presumably very few people would be trying to do this.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, all of that to say, like, explaining the covenanter position, it is the position of the majority of the Westminster divines, in some way or another. And they also held to just traditional Presbyterian views, and their writings about that are on these websites that really look just like the 1611 KJV onlyists, or the Stillwater Revival books, or the Arminian websites. What is there's another Arminian site. No, Calvinism. I'm not going to look it up. But these websites are just terrible. And a lot of people, they come to this. There's an article, Prince Messiah's. Well, there are articles that you'll look at and you'll just be like, well, I'm dismissing that out of hand because this looks like a crazy KJV only website.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I guess that's kind of part of what we're talking about today, is just how unfortunate it is that some good theology or good discussion that's worthy of having and having happen is completely ignored or neglected because the design is so poor that you can't get over the threshold there.
Yeah, and honestly, if it weren't for, like, there's an article that I read that helped convince me of the covenanter position, and if it weren't for the feature in iOS where you can tap on the little button on the left of the URL that puts it in reader mode and basically takes this text, extracts all the CSS from it, and makes it readable, I would have never read that article. Like, it just would have given, like, literally could have given me a headache.
Yeah. Yeah, I hate sites when sites are like that, and they've actually blocked that functionality. They've made it so you can't do that. It's like, oh,
yeah,
come on, you're killing
me.
They
don't do it on purpose, in fairness. It's just bad HTML at that point.
Right. Unless they do.
So on the other hand, Joe, we have your favorite author, Rob Bell.
Oh, man. He is so... Wow, we just got an email from Rob.
I should put my computer in Do Not Disturb or something. I just got an email from a guy named Rob, not Rob Bell.
Yeah, that's amazing. Though, that was pretty good timing. Yeah, so, like, I mean, Rob Bell's books are some of them are interesting. He raises some interesting questions. I don't think it's all garbage, but boy, there's a lot of bad theology.
It would be hard to say all garbage. Like, yeah. That would be a challenge.
Yeah, but he's got... The thing is, what he did do, and now they would look a little dated, some of them, but what he did do is, for the time and era in which he was popular, he had some very good designers on board that made really interesting-looking books and very thought-provoking, very eye-catching covers, and he had some massive bestsellers, partially because of that. Because I can't believe, personally, that they were bestsellers because of the contents of the book.
I actually think that they were probably... Well, I don't want to violate the Ninth Commandment here. But there is a method of getting a bestseller by having companies buy your book.
Yeah.
And it's pretty much accepted that most people in the industry do that. And I would be somewhat surprised to learn that he hadn't done that. Yes, Driscoll had done that. And honestly, like, I look at that and I think, yes, that's bad. But let's talk about all the other Christian authors who have done that too.
Well, yeah. I mean, the biggest thing with that was the lying about it and the diverting funds from missions stuff
and
do that.
I also don't, like, I am not a supporter of Mark Driscoll. That's not what I'm trying to do. All I'm saying is that is not on the high on the list of priorities of the problems I have with Driscoll.
Right.
So anyway, all of this to say, yeah, Bell's got some really nice looking books. I actually don't like the typography of his books. I think that it's, I read Love Wins, and that is set in, it's an almost geometric, I'm recalling this off the top of my head.
I read it on Kindle.
it's got an almost geometric sans font for the body copy, which is It's so if you can imagine Avner or it's not Futura, but if you can imagine trying to read an entire book set in Avner, it's pretty tedious. Although it sort of works because he doesn't actually have full paragraphs anyway, because the man is incapable, I think, of sustaining a thought for more than about three sentences.
Yeah, I think the book that I had originally of his was Velvet Elvis, and I read it and was like, okay, I've got some major concerns with some of the things he said here. And my wife wanted to read it, and she read it, and she would read a couple paragraphs, and then she would literally throw the book across the room. And I'm like, you have better discernment than me.
That would be such a good Giphy.
Oh my gosh. She was just like, and I'm like, I'm glad I didn't let you read this on my Kindle.
This is how Joe's devices get broken.
It's all about Rob Bell books.
And I just think that this is the saddest thing in the world, and that's why we wanted to talk about this. Okay, maybe not the saddest thing in the world, but when you think about it, this is soul murder that's happening, right? Like when somebody goes out, they buy Rob Bell's book, they come to the conclusion that from Love Wins, that there is no hell, and that penal substitutionary atonement is an allegory. Penal substitutionary atonement being the idea that Jesus died in our place for our sins, that he took the penalty that we deserved, that hence the word penal and substitution. Mm-hmm. They come to the conclusion that that's an allegory and that there is no hell and that everything's fine. And then they go to hell, right? That is soul murder. And good design is one of the things that helped it get there. And I'm not saying that people who...
By no means exclusively the design, by no means at all.
It helped. That's all I mean.
So you've got a designer who's a Christian.
Yeah, and maybe, that would be an interesting discussion in
Christian
itself.
Working at a Christian publisher, and they go, hey, here's this guy's book. We want you to do this, this, and this for the design. So it's not necessarily that the designer was like, oh, I read this book. It's got scary theological things in it, and so I want to make sure to make the cover really good and attractive because I hate Christians. I mean, that's not what we're saying by any means. Well, okay, he's saying that. He's definitely saying that. I am not. How dare you, Neil?
Nat. Where did you get Neil from?
I don't know. I can't read it from me. I'm looking at an iPhone 6
Plus
that's like 14 feet away from me, roughly.
And I mean, it's I think it's one thing for somebody to create a cover for a book that they know contains heresy and to try to, when you're designing that kind of thing, we've kind of had this conversation before. You're designing that thing so that people will buy it, and you're held culpable for, even if the episode is called It's a Bad Widget, right? You design the thing and people buy the thing because, or you design the product logo or whatever, people buy it partially because you made it so appealing, and they get this widget and it's a bad widget and it breaks on them, and now they're upset and they've wasted their money, and that's your fault. You've stolen from them in a sense. It's in part your fault. There's also the company that made the bad widget. There's also the there's a lot of moving parts. Except for the widget. The widget doesn't move.
Not typically, no.
Yeah, it's supposed to move, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And if it is supposed to move, if it isn't supposed to move, it does.
Yeah.
And it's the same with theology, right? Only I would argue that, if you make a widget, if you know that the widget kills people, it has been known to cause death.
we have to put up the disclaimer for Happy Fun Ball at some point. I'll link to that.
If you know that the widget has been known to cause death and you make the product artwork for it, you are culpable in some sense for that person's death. And so likewise, I think that if you make this isn't what we intended to talk about, but if you're the person doing the typesetting on a book that contains heresy, and you know that it contains heresy, that's soul murder. That's a serious, serious thing.
Yeah, that's a...
and you did it for money, right? That's why you're doing it, because you don't want to lose. And I understand. This is a. I'm not saying you,
did
Joe.
Did they pay you
Joe?
30 pieces of silver, Joe? Did they?
And I don't mean to imply that this isn't a more complicated issue than just, I'm not going to do it, and then you come into work tomorrow and everything's fine. Obviously, you've got to feed your family, and that's a concern too. But I mean, in my opinion, I'm coming out strongly on this. I didn't intend for us to talk about this or to come out strongly on this, but in my opinion, you have to say no to that. And you don't get to prevent yourself from sinning passively by sinning actively.
Yeah, and another thing that's nice about it is it makes
that
it,
wasn't said well. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it makes it so that we don't have to put disclaimers on our podcast anymore.
Yeah.
Good times.
So anyway, getting back into this, I do think it is really, it's maybe not the saddest thing in the world, but I think it is really profoundly sad that the wolves, well, they're wolves in sheep's clothing, right? And our problem is that our sheep, you know, they run around in I was going to say wolves clothing. But,
okay, so you say that that's the saddest thing in the world.
Okay, it's not the saddest thing in the world.
But have you ever seen...
Stomped on a puppy?
The ASPCA commercial with the Sarah McLachlan song?
I have.
Yeah. Saddest thing in the world.
Do you want to talk about that instead, Joe?
We might just save our bacon here. Let's go. No, but I honestly, your point is really well taken. I think it's important that we as designers realize that there really is a God in heaven who is looking down, who is aware of us and our actions, and is watching us, and we are accountable. And I think, I don't mean to put this in some sort of a, like some, put it out in some sort of a legalistic area that's, you know, that's making us earn our salvation by being Christian enough designers and doing enough Thomas Kincaid, you know, paintings so that we can go to heaven. You know, that's not what I'm saying, but what I am saying is that we have to live in the awareness of the reality of God, the reality of the truth of Scripture, and the reality of hell.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, not to, like, as Joe was saying, we don't want to be legalists here. We do acknowledge and affirm, and we want to be very clear that for every sin, there is forgiveness in Jesus Christ. But that doesn't mean that we would then, you know, we see something that is sin and we then want to just go ahead and do it because it's convenient for us. As if anything, the cross should make us want to not spurn that grace that God has given us, and not say, oh, I'm going to live in sin or I'm going to do this sin. I mean, if Christ suffered that much, I think we can lose our job over obedience. Like that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And also the cross teaches us that God loves us enough to keep us, to preserve us, to, you know, Romans 8 says that God works everything out for the good of those who love him and are called according to his word. And we see the ultimate example of that or the ultimate proof of that at the cross. If God spared not his own son, then of course he's going to do whatever needs to be done in order to, you know, for our good. So anyway, back to the books, Joe.
Yeah. Well, I think, why don't we take a turn a little bit here and talk about where you can have beautiful design about a good thing, but it's not usable.
Yeah, because that's another movement, another thing that I've noticed.
Yeah, because there's a lot of churches that are using some, and I do not know specific templates. I don't know who's putting them out or anything.
We're
going to
put out a list of churches that have bad websites.
That's right. That's exactly what we're going to do. No, but like churches will use these kind of, they're these cool, really nice looking templates. They're very, you know, they're very aesthetically pleasing. They're, you know, really nice color choices. They have good, you know, they have good white space. They have good kerning. They have, everything is nice. It looks really good.
They're using thin fonts.
Thin fonts, yeah.
And it's not Comic Sans. I'm sorry, I'm just saying simplistic things.
It's only Comic Sans. I said good websites. So they obviously have papyrus, just papyrus. Because if it's good enough for Paul. If it's good enough for his PowerPoint, it's good enough for me. No, but you have like a nice website. And this is something that I've struggled with quite a bit. Because my wife and I have been hunting, looking for a church to go to. And so we go to church websites. You'll get to the website. It's this beautiful, handsome website. Really nice. Neat pictures of the people doing, you know, hanging out and fellowshipping and all that. And then I can't figure out, when is the sermon? Where is the church? What do you believe? you know, kind of fundamental church website stuff.
I actually was just looking at a Presbyterian site, a PCA church website, and I could not find any statement on the website about how they affirm the Westminster Standards. And like, you have to in order to be a PCA church, but they didn't even say they were. I knew that it was a PCA church.
Right.
But they did not say anything about that or about the fact that like their theology statement was like five affirmations. We affirm these things. And it was just like, I mean, it was worse than most like, you know, non-denominational churches where you see the maybe it's a 600 word statement. This was like a 200 word, maybe 150 word statement.
Wow.
On a PCA church. And that was, I don't mean to diss that church. Like, I'm sure they hold to the Westminster Standards, and I'm sure that they, or at least I hope they do. And I'm sure that doctrine matters to them, but it didn't matter to their web designer.
Right.
Or I don't want to say that either, but it didn't occur to the web designer. It didn't occur in the design process to put that on there.
Yeah. This is this fundamental thing about what it means to be a PCA church. You should probably have that in there somewhere and not just hidden 14 pages deep that you have to find by going to domain/index.html.
Yeah, you have to know how to type the URL in. Just right. Start entering gibberish. No, gibberish would be an AOG church. Sorry.
Ouch.
But I'm because tongues.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's pray for interpretation of that noise I just made.
Let's not. Yeah, no, that's, I actually was looking at so there's a conference in Portland, and I do not want to diss this conference at all, or the designers involved in it. It was a beautiful, beautiful website. If you look up the Canvas conference, it's happening in Portland. I think it starts tomorrow, actually. Tomorrow, as of the day that we're recording this, so like 6 or 8 weeks ago by the time this actually goes out. No, but they had this beautiful website. For the life of me, it took me forever to find out that it, I think they mentioned that it was in Portland, but actually like finding the building location was really hard. And then actually finding the date was the hardest thing. Like I searched 4 pages before I finally found it.
It's a conference.
And shouldn't that be
the
on the homepage?
Date is fairly important.
Again, though, beautiful website, beautiful photography, like very clearly up to date with, I mean, there was parallax, but it wasn't like the kind of disorienting or unhelpful parallax. Like it was just a really nice site. I just, I think there's two sides to that. You know, there's the information, making sure you get the information to people. And then there's making sure that you do it in a beautiful way. And I think when you look at the Scottish Covenanter websites or the Puritan Hard Drive website, they get the one right. We've talked about this distinction before, but they get the information right. They've got really good information, and then they get the aesthetic completely wrong.
Right. Yeah, and the aesthetic is so wrong that it's off-putting.
Right.
It'll actually keep people from reading the good information that you have.
I guess I'm not going to this conference.
Yeah, I mean, that's
horrible. Can't figure out when it is.
Right. So, anyway, it'd be interesting. We'd be interested in hearing you guys' feedback on that, you know, just what thoughts you guys have.
Lewis is upset. I'm not dissing Canvas as a conference. I from what I've heard, they're up to some really cool things.
No,
I want to check out the talks when they're online.
The website clearly indicates that. No, I honestly haven't looked at the website at all. I have heard about it, and I have heard good about it.
Yeah, so
that's not at all what we're saying. We're
literally just
negative.
Just a mistake on the website in terms of the design is all we're trying to bring up. Just like a lot of churches.
Yeah, and it's the thing is that here's a critical thing. If you are doing church websites, please make it so you can find meeting times and locations, statement of faith, staff info, those things. Just critical.
Well, yeah, and another thing would be what to expect on Sunday morning, because like, I don't know. I feel like it's always helpful to know, like, what are people going to be wearing? If I show up in a tux, am I going to be overdressed?
You know, and actually with what you said just now, LaRosa, on the live feed, don't be dissing the conference, bro.
Yeah, come on, LaRosa. LaRosa just said that the website is hard to navigate.
Yeah.
And that he'll grant us that.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, where do you put your kids? They should be in the service with you. And then it was really uncomfortable.
Yes. This was... Yes. Well, yeah, that actually, and there's
this is actually, so I designed I didn't do the aesthetic design for my church's website. I did the information design because we had one designer who was really good at the, you know, color theory and all of that.
Sorry, I was smiling. I won't do it again.
I thought you were going to say something like, hey.
No.
So we had one designer who's really good at the aesthetic, the color theory and all of that. And then me, I tend, especially at that point in my career, I was really focused on UX stuff. So what I did was I actually drew up like profiles of different people, and we have like different colleges in our area. We have, so I drew up like, what would it look like if a Moody student, like what would they be looking for? What would a Whitworth student be looking for? What would a family that just moved to Spokane be looking for? What would a family that came out of a good church but needed to relocate for, you know, whatever reasons, and then what would a family maybe that came out of a church that had really bad doctrine, what would they be looking for? And like, not that we would like tailor the message so that we're not saying offensive things about the gospel on the website or anything, but just keeping in mind like what are they going to be expecting, what are they going to, what's important to these different groups of people, and then imagining those people running through the website, and like they're going to want to know where it is, they're going to want to know when it is, they're going to want to know, you know, the Moody students are going to be really concerned with our statement of faith. That should be really clear. The people who moved in here, they're probably going to be more concerned with I mean, I don't want to say probably, like they could be really, really into doctrine, but they're also going to be concerned about when it is. They're going to want a link to a map because they don't know Spokane that well. So stuff like that.
Yeah. I think all that stuff is important. And there's a kind of a technical term for doing that, isn't there? It's at the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember.
Yeah. Now that you can't remember it, now I can't remember
it. Yeah. So it's basically, but you,
I think one term is profiling.
Yeah.
No, that's a bad thing.
Right. I think what it's a thought exercise, and it's a matter of not just stopping at, the beauty or the aesthetic of the design, but going on through, but actually thinking in terms of kind of getting yourself out of your own head, because a lot of times as a, you know, let's say, well, I'm at this particular church and I've been there for 5 years. I'm real comfortable with it. I know everyone there. So what do I want for this church website? Well, I want to see something that shows the different people, shows these different things about the church. But you're like, well, obviously, you know, it's just right here on, you know, 5th and Washington. That's where the church is, or wherever it happens to be. You don't think about the fact that someone would come to that church that wouldn't know where the church is because you're so familiar with that. It's kind of like when you're riding in the car with someone, and you're, you know, someone's giving you a ride to your apartment. You're like, oh, okay. And then they go, oh, shoot, you should have turned just there. Well, the reason you did that is because you've turned there 1,000 times. So for you, it's just old hat. Obviously, that's where you turn. And it's easy to forget, oh, right, other people who are coming at it from a different perspective might be looking for different information, or you might want to make certain things easier to get to or more accessible for those people.
Yeah, and the creation of they're called personas.
Personas, yes, yeah. Yes, thank
and
you.
So then you'll run those through either, sometimes they're called use cases, that this has various names. And you can get as in-depth with these personas as you want to. This isn't a UX podcast, but yeah, what you want to do is, I mean, if you can imagine a story of, you know, Bill and Eileen moved from Nebraska and they have 2 kids, and they, you know, this is their backstory, and they've already visited 3 churches. They heard some really bad just make stuff up. And then like, what are they going to be looking for when they come to the website? Well, they're going to want to see the sermons. They're probably going to want to listen to a sermon before they come so that they can know that, you know, that we're reasonably solid, that sort of thing.
Right. Yep.
But then the other side of that is, I wasn't responsible for this on our website, but, again, making sure that the whole thing looks appealing. And that's kind of expected now. It's kind of like people just expect to come and look at a good church website. Like if your church website is ugly, it's not going to keep people from visiting necessarily. But even like that first contact, it's going to color everything they see from that point on.
Right. Yep.
You also want to make sure that your church website isn't a whole lot nicer than your actual church building and the people. Because that can actually create dissonance. Like I'm being kind of serious here. Like Like, if you've got a church of like 20 people, you shouldn't try to make it, you know, 20 people and they're all old. You probably shouldn't be making it look like it's a church for young people with 300 people, you know, in a satellite campus.
Yeah. Yeah. Trying to be, again, that's comes back to understanding your audience. And part of your audience for your church website, obviously, is the church body that fellowships with you or fellowships at that church.
Yeah.
You know, understanding that you want to identify well with them without being off-putting to, you know, to someone else who might be investigating whether to attend there.
Yeah. And you don't want to make it only appealing to old people. Obviously you want to make it appealing to young people, but you don't want to make it so that when they come there, they're shocked by what they see. Like, you want to make it clear, no, this is what you should expect. And your design can help that. I'm not going to get into practical ways. If people want like ideas, I'm not going to come up with them off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Maybe some Comic Sans though.
Definitely Comic Sans. You got to have that. That and blink tags.
Francis Turretin. Wow. that guy. I like that guy. He wrote The Institutes of Eclectic Theology, which is what my tripod is sitting on right now. Because I use it so much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But they're referencing some really old tags, HTML tags that would cause text to slide like a ticker tape or blink, and they should have never been created.
I think I read a Medium article. I think it was an article on Medium, probably cross-posted from somewhere, where they had an interview with the person who actually invented the blink tag, and he talked about like how it was almost sort of an accident when they first did it, and then somebody saw it, and they did it as a joke.
I think
somebody
I read this.
Saw it, and they were like, oh, that's amazing. It was like, no.
That's like when you're working with a client and you draw something up as like a joke or as like a really quick example of the, well, we could just imagine if it's a toaster, and then they want the whole website to be a toaster.
Yes.
Like, theme it like a toaster. That made sense to me.
Oh, no. Yeah. 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 Been there.
You should write down that Medium article. We should see if we can find it for the show notes.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, there are these two sides to design. There's the aesthetics. And I think that as a designer, you really want to, you want to grow in both of these. So we see that God has made both a beautiful world, and we see that God has made a world that works and makes sense to us. Like, we can figure out how to, like, trees, we figure out how to climb trees. God could have made trees that were inscrutable, that were not climbable. He could have made the world a lot less obvious to use, and a lot more people would die because they couldn't figure out, like, how do I eat food? No, but seriously, somebody once said that the only truly intuitive interface is the hamburger. And then somebody once said, actually, no, like, there are whole people groups that if you hand them a hamburger, they can't figure it out. The only truly, this is about to get rated like PG, but the only truly intuitive interface is the nipple. Yeah. And arguably that's sort of the case.
This right here, this is a microphone. Right there, inline microphone. I can't afford to drop these ones.
Nat Dunn, you asked how many times we bring up Comic Sans. Actually, I think people are starting to develop a drinking game based around how many times I mention Comic Sans. So,
but not in the Baptist viewers, only the Reformed.
Well, they
viewers.
Just don't want us to know about it.
They still have it.
There's a joke that's. How do you keep a Baptist from stealing your beer when you go fishing?
How?
Bring two Baptists.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. Anyway, but you need to be growing in both of these. I think it's very easy. It's very common for designers to grow in color theory, in, you know, photography, in making stuff look really, really pretty. And like the Canvas website, where it's just stunningly beautiful. And then you go to look for actually a piece of information that you need on the website or on the flyer, and you can't find it because they were thinking about how do I make this pretty, not how do I actually resolve this user's issues. And at the same time, these Covenanter websites or the Puritan Hard Drive, etc. I didn't even mention PNR titles from the 1960s. Good books, Presbyterian and Reformed. Publishers, good books in the 1960s. I have a copy. I don't know if it's the 60s or a little earlier or a little later. I have a book by Cornelius Van Til, which was hard to read anyway, that is the font on it is just so hard to read. It took me twice as long as it should have. And it was Cornelius Antilles, so it took me four times as long as it should have. we need to be taking these things into account.
Well, and sometimes if you have really, really modern design too, maybe your design is really on the nose for, you know, 2016. This is going to be something that's really going to hit with people in 2016. But if it's so, you know, so current and so cutting edge, a lot of times it's not going to be a design that stands the test of time. That, you know, you get that book gets to be a couple of years old. Just go and look in the, you can look anywhere, but I think it's particularly poignant in the Christian section of a used bookstore.
For sure.
Because you'll see these things, you're like, whoa, okay, that is a 1980s book. For sure. that's not just a Christian thing. That's a book design thing and a design thing in general. But you can see there's certain things that have that, they have an aesthetic that stands the test of time, and then there's things that have an aesthetic that's very much the aesthetic of its time and no further.
Yeah, and that's I feel like this is one of the differences between reading books on design and reading blog articles on design. It's more like a, it's not universal, right? There are books that only focus on modern design trends to the neglect of principles, and there are websites that really, really do a good job of explaining design principles and stay away from or don't generally talk about just trends. But generally speaking, if you're reading nothing but design blogs and no books, you're going to know a lot about design in May of 2016, but you're not going to know a lot about gestalt theory. You're not going to know a lot about color theory. And it's important to do both. It's important to stay up to date enough, especially if you're making stuff for pop culture. Like, church websites should generally be more hip than maybe a book design, because the book needs to stand the test of time, whereas the church is probably going to want a new website in 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. You can kind of keep those things current. Whereas a book, it's, you know, it's a physical object. It's going to be there. So, I'm going to say something brilliant.
Oh, I know. I could feel it.
Yeah. Nope. I got nothing. Sorry. See, this is the problem with the live feed thing, because sometimes we would do this before we were doing the live feed.
It's so true.
And we could just take that minute of silence and go, oop, bye.
The difference between Joe and I is I can ramble on about like nothing at all for 2 minutes while I'm thinking about what it is I actually want to say.
Right. And I can do that too, but I already did it last night with my six kids. They just suck all the questions out of you and all the rambling. There's nothing left. No. Well, anyway, I think we kind of need to put a bow on this. So, you have any final thoughts on this particular topic? Good theology with bad design, or bad theology with good design? I actually really appreciated where you went with it, of doing, you know, soul murder when you are encouraging bad theology through your good design. And there's a whether it's I think whether it's something that you're aware of, and or whether it's something that's like, oh gosh, I had no idea that was the content, you know, something that you come up to later, is there's very different takes on that. But
right, I think there's still a level of culpability. Like, I think that if you're a Christian and working in Christian publishing, you are obligated to do some level of research on the books that you're promoting. You know, the authors, like, I don't think that it's responsible to make stuff without doing at least, you know, basic, like looking up the Wikipedia article on the author, that sort of thing. I think that that's kind of reckless. You could call that, right? If promoting a book that leads somebody to hell is an element of soul murder. I think that not even doing the research and just not caring is equivalent to what is the term? Reckless endangerment.
Yeah. There was a discussion that happened in a terrible movie that has some great dialogue. I do not recommend the movie. It's a movie called Clerks by Kevin Smith. Again, it's a vile movie in some areas, so I strongly do not recommend it. But there are some monologues in it, and one of which was a discussion about, the rebels are acting like they're the good guys, but what about all the people, the people who did maintenance work on the Death Star, the people who were involved in the construction of the next Death Star, the construction crews that are there. What about those people? And the conclusion they came to, of course, was, well, you're helping to build the Death Star, or you're helping to do maintenance or housekeeping on the Death Star. Maybe you were paid well, but you were working for the devil. So, yep.
Yeah, for sure. And there's that argument, well, somebody else is going to do it. I think that's probably the case. Somebody else is going to do it.
Yeah.
But gosh darn it, if a company every time they release heresy burns through three employees who refuse to do it and they have to let them go, something might give.
Yeah.
At least in their hiring policies.
Yeah. Make sure these people don't have much in the way of theological acumen.
How do you feel about the Ten Commandments? The Ten what? You're hired.
You're in. I don't know how to hold a pencil. No problem.
Well, and then they get the bad design, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Besides the practical outworkings of this, I think what I mean by practical is besides the we're talking about how this deals with the second commandment, right? How bad design in good books and good design in bad books. Yeah, I said that right. How that deals with loving your neighbor. There's also the element of loving God. So we talked about these two verses last week, Colossians 3:23 and 24, whatever you do your work heartily is for the Lord. I think in doing your work heartily, especially when your design, when your job is specifically a skill, increasing in your skill and applying that skill and doing the thing well, is important there. And again, as we seek to do better work, do you see a man skillful in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. Proverbs 22:29. I think that also applies to the work that we put into our book covers, or the church website. I think that there's an element there where when we do good design, I'm not saying President Barack Obama is going to come to your church because you had such a good website.
But he might.
He might. Yeah, I'm basically saying that he will.
He definitely will.
That's how that proverb works.
And that's how you do a Eighth Commandment violation.
And then you have the contrary to that. The hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be... I'm reading out of the KJV. The slothful shall be under tribute. So the idea that the man who works hard will be promoted, and the slothful, the lazy person will end up a slave. The last thing I have here, and then I'll maybe turn it over to you, Joe, for any final thoughts, is that even the heathen recognize that if they have a great topic, so if they're writing about a king or if they're writing about something that they really care about, they should adorn that thing in a glorious way. They should make that thing look glorious. And we're compelled by the majesty of our subject to seek excellence in its presentation. So when we're working on good theology, when we're working on something that deals with the doctrine of God or the doctrines of God, we should seek excellence in how we present those things, because it just makes sense. You wouldn't make a poor garment for a king. You shouldn't make poor garments for writings about the king. And so I would say that to not do this is to profane the things of God. It is in a sense a third commandment violation. The third commandment being not to take the name of the Lord your God in vain. This idea of not giving it the weight that it's due. And we need to recognize and respect God's name in every aspect of how we deal with it. Not just in maybe what we say, but also how we say it or how we present the words that we've said or written.
Yeah, I was thinking of, as you were saying this, the book of Malachi, where he's talking about polluted offerings.
Yeah. Yeah. That came to mind for me as well.
Yeah. So Malachi chapter 1, verses 6 to 7. This is NKJV. A son honors his father and a servant his master. If I then am the father, where is my honor? And if I am a master, where is my reverence? Says the Lord of hosts. So it's God speaking. To you priests who despise my name, yet you say, in what way have we despised your name? You offer defiled food on my altar, but you say, in what way have we defiled you? By saying the table of the Lord is contemptible. And when you offer the blind as a sacrifice, is it not evil? And when you offer the lame and sick, is it not evil? Offer it then to your governor. Will he be pleased with you? Will he accept you favorably? Says the Lord of hosts. But now entreat God's favor, that he may be gracious, that he may be gracious to us. While this is being done by your hands, will he accept you favorably, says the Lord of hosts. And it goes on and on. And he basically ends up saying, I have no pleasure in you. So, I mean, a lot of times it's kind of like when a church does, when a church says, you know, bring in clothing and lightly used furniture. We have some people, some refugees that are coming in that we're helping to, you know, helping to get them set up in apartments and things like that. So bring those things in so that we can bless them. And how many people use that as like kind of a glorified dump run? They just bring in the worst and the most terrible stuff. Yep. It's like, you know, make sure that those things that you are doing, as we, you know, as it says, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord. Think about if you were doing that design for the Lord. I mean, I think it's a good perspective to kind of keep in mind.
Yeah. And I don't want to get too thick into the weeds here. The reason I didn't bring that passage, I definitely agree with like virtually everything you just said. The reason I didn't bring that passage up is because it's in relation to worship, and holding to the regulative principle. I wouldn't want to apply that passage directly without explaining that, yeah, we're supposed to do everything as hardly as for the Lord. Sure. But there's a difference between offering a sacrifice, which was an act of worship under the old covenant, and creating a website, which is still to be done as for the Lord. There's just a, there's kind of a conceptual difference there. But it, I mean, I don't take issue with anything you said.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. I just wasn't fair. Confident in my ability to articulate it without accidentally violating the right or encouraging people to violate the regulative principle.
Sure.
And we're going to do an episode on that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that because I think David and I have different perspectives on that. And I think we could have an interesting discussion on our takes on that.
For sure. All right. Well, you ready to do recommendations?
You know, actually, I don't have a recommendation today. Do you have one?
I do have. Okay. I do have one. So first, actually, I have two recommendations. One is specifically related to theology, because I've said a few things here that maybe seemed odd, specifically in relation to the Ten Commandments, where I talked about the idea of soul murder or the idea of the third commandment being violated when we don't dress, say, dress God's word or dress adorn good theology correctly. A lot of that came out of the Westminster, it comes out of Reformed theology, traditional Reformed theology. You can get kind of a really brief treatment of that in the Westminster Shorter Catechism. But Joe and I, and LaRosa and a number of others are going through a book called Questions and Answers on the Shorter Catechism by John Brown, which really just takes the Shorter Catechism and drills down into each question in the Shorter Catechism and asks a whole bunch of questions about that. Like, what do you mean by this term, this or that term? And here's a backwards picture of it for the video. but yeah, really good book. I found it really helpful. So that would be my theological recommendation. And then my more design-related recommendation, I found an app this week. They don't have it updated for the iPad Pro yet, which is lame. But I found an app this week for viewing fonts. And it's really, it's not a fantastic app, but it has a huge library. It's called Fontbook. I think it's a $3 app. You can sort by class. You can sort by year, designer, usage, foundry. They've got some articles here. And you can just look through all of these fonts. I find it useful.
Wow, that is really cool.
Yeah. So you can just, and you know, it might not be a font that you're looking to buy, but maybe you're looking for a font that's similar to one that you own. And you can drill down from like, so you've got serif here. I can look at transitional serif, French old style, Venetian old style, neoclassical, and free slash hybrid fonts. Or I could drill into like not just look at sans serif, but to look specifically at geometrics sans serif fonts. And this is done by the is this My Fonts? I think it is. I think that's the company that put this out. So they just got an extensive library. So you can look that up on the App Store. It's called Fontbook.
Fontbook. Cool. Yeah, I'll have to check that one out. That's really compelling. Do they have an iPhone version of that, or is it only?
Yeah, iPad? I believe so.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's about all I've got. So, yeah. So anyway, I just wanted to say thanks everyone for joining us today. Thanks for taking the time to listen. And if you have any feedback for us, make sure to touch base with us. You can find us on our Facebook channel. You can get an invite to that. It's a private channel, so we have to let you in, but
group.
Yeah. Our Facebook group.
Also our Slack page.
Or our Slack page. Oh boy. Anyway. On the Twitters, you know, actually, if you just go to helveticpodcast.com, you can find us.
Yeah. That's the easiest way to find all the different, well, we need to put our Slack up there, but. Or our Slack channel, yeah. On the Tech Reformation. Thank you, Tech Reformation.
Yeah, thank you, guys. We really appreciate it.
Or you can call 707-99-TULIP to leave us a voicemail. We haven't had many voicemails.
That's 707-998-8547 for you Armenians out there.
Like, I can't buy tulips. I can't type tulip. I can't even say dang it.
You just said it four times. Oh.
All right.
Anyway. Okay. Well, anyway, thanks, you guys. God bless. And we'll see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
And now for a legal disclaimer.
David and I both work for Olive Tree, a division of HarperCollins Christian Publishers. We produce these podcasts for ourselves, not for our company. And the opinions we express in this podcast are our own opinions and not necessarily those of Olive Tree.